Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Citizen diplomacy is an idea developed during the Cold War. The idea is that regular people can help build bridges to peace when governments involved have limited contacts. Let's hear from two citizen diplomats just back from Iran. Sean Reynolds is a hospital secretary. Sarah Ball is a psychiatric nurse. Both are members of the peace organization Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and they went to Iran with the peace organization Code Pink. Nice to meet you, Sean and Sarah.
Hello.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to, if we could start in Iran, gift-giving and hospitality were very important. I wanted to
It is everywhere in the world except the United States, it seems.
Yeah. I wanted to present this gift to you picked up on a sort of a road stop on the way between Qom and Isfahan in a tray outside a toy store. It might be a joke gift. It's Never Give Up by Donald Trump in Persian.
Wow. So they've got the works of Donald Trump just right out there. And it says it's an international bestseller right
and
here.
And Tony Robbins. One of the copies I've got, I think, of The Art of the – it wasn't The Art of the Deal – has Animal Farm international bestseller. And I don't know why in the little band on the front.
Well, there you go. Donald Trump right there with Persian letters and everything. That's
looking
cool.
Looking very stern there.
You know, that kind of brings to thought about an idea about freedom of expression in Iran and what it's like. I think some people might think, well, it's kind of a limited amount of freedom of expression. What was your experience with this, Sarah?
I found that especially during the latter part of the trip when we were in Isfahan, when we didn't have people, you know, our guides watching over us the entire time, we did a lot of walking around in the city and in the bazaar, and I found that walking around myself as an obvious American, I found lots of people coming up to me and wanting to talk and wanting to tell me about Iran. And one of the people I ran into was a 19-year-old young man who immediately invited me out for coffee and cake and took me to a very modern-looking cafe and sat me down, all these people were around, and proceeded to tell me all of his political opinions, many that I had not heard thus far on the trip, about Iran. And he held nothing back. And I was even nervous for him at the beginning. I thought, can you say these things in a cafe with who knows who listening in? He told me about the corruption in Iran and how he would love to go to America. But nevertheless, he was very, very proud of his country, as all Iranians we met were, I found. But he said every single thing on his mind in a crowded cafe in one of the largest cities in Iran. And I found that was common on the trip.
Now, you had a conversation, I know, with students at Tehran University that sounded pretty freewheeling. It sounded like everybody was saying whatever they wanted.
Well, we don't know what they wanted, but it was a lively debate. People were people in person are incredibly hospitable and polite, and then anonymously, people can despise the hell out of you. The phrase we had a discussion about the phrase "death to America," which gets in the press here. It's idiomatic. It means down with America. Like if I said to hell with you, I don't mean that literally. And they were saying, well, we get to say that because we don't trust you. We saw what you did to our democracy in 1953. You backed Saddam against us in the 1980s. And so we reject the whole package. These were young professors and students in the American Studies Department. The young women were wearing – a lot of them were wearing the chador. The headscarf is obligatory except in there's some towns where people are in the chador. In government buildings, the offices, you want to wear one too. If I don't need to wear one to get in. The U.S.-born Iranian journalist recently arrested and released. Marzia Hashemi was one of the panelists. And then Ara Enright and Medea Benjamin were the others.
And Enright is with Veterans for Peace and was a veteran who was against the Iraq War.
Correct.
And just to chime in about the Tehran discussion, one of the women stood up and said that death to America for her was something that she had chanted in a protest on the previous week. And for her, it wasn't so much about death to America. It was about, as she said, encouraging the others around her and trying to promote a different worldview. That is, a worldview in which America is not the power that's enforcing its own hegemony all over the world. So it's to disrupt the current power.
We went to Iran because America is overall a worse human rights abuser, not against its own people as much as the Iranian government is against its people. But we brought chaos to Iraq. We brought chaos to Libya. We're bringing chaos to Syria, to Yemen, where maybe 14 million people will die this year from famine. We're assisting. There's a fight in the Senate right now to lodge a sort of senatorial protest against the weapons we're sending for that war. And in Iran, people see that the U.S. as a worse enemy. A lot of people would like to live here. It's a great place to live. They see the U.S. as a worse enemy to Iran even than its own government, which is why they seem to flee into the arms of their own hardliners whenever we elect hardliners. Under Bush, they elected Ahmadinejad. Under Trump, Lurk knows what they're going to do in the coming and next year's elections.
You know, I want to pick up on something you were saying, Sarah, about basically the independent thinking of the people at Tehran University. It's something you had a chance to meet with Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, sat down and spent 90 minutes with you, incredibly. He seems to underline independence. I mean, he kind of walked through a scenario where he said, well, what is the problem that the U.S. has with us? It's our independence, he thinks. So can you flesh out what would happen there?
One of the things he focused on a lot was about how you can't have peace in your own country at the expense of every other country because you're promoting chaos everywhere else. And you can't have an island, you know, a strong island in the midst of, you know, just a craziness everywhere else. So he said that if you want to have peace in your own country, you have to do that diplomatically and recognize the independent existence of other countries, whatever that might mean. And that was something, in his opinion, that the U.S. was definitely not doing at all. And that was something that he was promoting for Iran in the Middle East, that Iran, a country of its size and its population, should have a certain amount of say in the Middle East. And currently, it has none. Under the policies of U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel.
He argued persuasively that the Saudi Arabia far better fits the caricature of Iranian regional destabilization and oppression of women, specifically. And it's a more dictatorial country than Iran. So why is it our close ally that Jared Kushner is talking about sending nuclear technology, and Trump is Iran is the great threat? It's a rational country. Even if it got some of the weapons we have, it's not going to use them because that would be suicide. And there's only the worst bigots in America think that members of any one religion are irrational or suicidal. That's an incredible suicidal irrationality in its own right.
And I just like to say that Zarif himself spent many, many years in the United States. He studied in University of Denver, and he spent 6 years in San Francisco, he said. And I found that was very common on our trip. So many people from all different classes and levels of life had spent an extensive amount of time in other countries.
I met a man in the main square in Isfahan where he had been interviewed in 2009 by The Daily Show. They came to interview people in Iran, and he'd worked for an American company. He knew all about us because when you're a weak country, you have to know what the strong country is doing. It's a survival issue. So he was listing off all the U.S. presidents and the system of government, and then they would cut to Times Square asking Americans about Iran. And they're saying, wait, is that in Egypt?
I'm talking with Sean Reynolds and Sarah Ball. They're both members of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and we're talking about their trip to Iran with the organization Code Pink, and they took a tour with them. I wanted to ask some about sanctions and how the sanctions that the U.S. has reimposed on Iran are hurting. Do you end up talking to people who are affected by the sanctions in Iran? Do you see that?
It's a proud country, and people didn't want to complain about weakness. We had to draw people out about the economy, which is partially suffering from a lot of corruption from the clerical oligarchy there, and suffering from the sanctions. Right now, they have record flooding In Iran, I think it's 62 dead, and they're suffering from a lack of relief choppers because those are some of the prohibited devices, prohibited technology. We were largely concerned. We heard stories about people who couldn't send getaway for cancer treatment. We met for one Iranian kickboxer who is dying for a particular match with someone from the U.S., but I think it's the travel restrictions blocking her there. The insult in the sanctions. I mean, the sanctions are taking lives because they're increasing poverty and in a lot of little ways. But the sanctions are also risking getting us back into a path towards war. So that walking out of the Iran nuclear deal, reneging on our promises as Trump has done, is setting Iran up to say, okay, we're going to start spinning the centrifuges again. It's a non-nuclear program. It's nuclear power. We're going to start spinning the centrifuges again, and then Trump can start up the drumbeat towards war, Trump and John Bolton. And that seems to be their focus on an apocalyptic war that would make the Iraq war look trite.
And one of the things that I heard about the sanctions many times over is that we've had sanctions for 40 years, that is, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. And I agree with Sean that you can't expect the Iranian people to say, oh, we're feeling it so bad, we're hurting so much, just take these awful, you know, sanctions off of us so we can express ourselves again. Their point is that they are a strong, proud country that has a lot to say for it. And yes, I heard many, many stories, and I think we all did, about how, you know, people couldn't, you know, I heard one story about how a woman's cousin there wasn't the equipment for a blood transfusion in time. So he died, even though there was a donor with his rare blood type right there waiting to go. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of such stories, but they've been saying, we've been under sanctions for 40 years. We know what it's like. We're still doing what we do. Mm-hmm.
You also had some interesting experiences at this nuclear facility you were mentioning there. They wanted to take you to a nuclear facility. How much of the tour did you feel like this is what they want us to do or see or something?
We had three places we needed to go. We needed to go appropriately to the large – what's the name of this? I've got it in my notes. The large a large cemetery outside of Tehran, which is also houses some of the million war dead from the 1980s, the Iran-Iraq War, when Saddam Hussein, with U.S. backing, invaded Iran, sensing weakness after the 1979 revolution. And we wound up arming both sides. It was part of the Iran-Contra deal, but we definitely sided with Iraq and wound up shooting down accidentally. It's quite possible it was accidental, shooting down an Iranian passenger jet. We certainly maintained it was, but in deference to world sentiment, we have to – a lot of people don't believe that. And that was 290 people who died in that crash.
The whole Iran-Iraq war is something that I think most people don't, you know, have a hard time grasping the significance of in the Iranian mindset, you know. But I imagine when you're there and you're seeing people, I bet you saw a bunch of people who were veterans of the Iraq war. And you gain a deeper appreciation of their, you know, what they want, how it fixes in with their strategy and their ideas about missiles and their ideas about defense. And yeah. It's a very deep thing. There a lot of people died.
One of the neocon hawk arguments here is that they're building missiles with a very, very low payload. So with conventional explosives, that'll take down one building maximum in a war. They're very weak missiles. So mustn't you be building this in order to deliver a nuclear payload? And they're saying no one will sell us arms. We had no missiles. Saddam rained down missiles on our city, so the public wants missiles. It's not a democracy in Iran, but they have very consequential elections. It matters if the hardliners or the reformers are in. And they have to listen to the public, and the public wants to have whatever the United States says they can't have, which is a level of involvement and national pride I think might further democratize this country if we invested a bit more in it. And they want missiles, and so they're building missiles. There's no proof of a nuclear option. They had Saddam used chemical weapons, and we helped supply the precursors of the weapons, and we helped the Defense Intelligence Agency was targeting Iranian troops for chemical weapons attacks, mustard gas, stuff that had rarely, if ever, been seen since World War I. And And we met a gentleman, a war veteran staff to the Tehran Peace Museum, and met a gentleman who will be coughing in spasmodic racking coughs every few minutes for the rest of his life, and a gentleman who has to constantly irrigate his eyes because of damage to his face. He told us he can't get eye drops because of the sanctions. He uses an onion to make himself cry.
And these guys are veterans who were employed at the Peace Museum in.
They were eloquent testimony to the need to resolve these conflicts.
Yes, and they were veterans that I think one of them was the director of the Peace Museum.
He was in a wheelchair.
And right after the Peace Museum, we went to the cemetery, which Sean was talking about earlier. And the thing that struck me was that there were pictures of over every single grave of all of the war dead, many of them children, because so many children died in trench-style warfare, harkening back to World War I in the 80 to 88 Iran-Iraq war. And I think it's another indication of how Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, said that Iranians are historical, going back to the martyrdom of the Imam Hussein in the 7th century. Like, that's important for them. The poetry of the past hundreds of years are important for them. The Iran-Iraq war is important. Mm-hmm. And all of these things form the Iranian consciousness, because Iran is a great country with thousands of years of history.
We stopped by a museum. There was it's 7,000 years, and it's 2,500 years of monarchy, continuous monarchy up until 1979. We stopped by a museum. They had a Zoroastrian bas-relief on the wall, a picture of Ahura Mazda, who our tour guide described as a king of exceptional piety. He's an actual Zoroastrian deity, but one of our tour guides felt he had to Islamicize him and to they seize on their history, on poets singing about wine, yeah, and try to integrate that as well into their Islamic faith.
Would you recommend a trip to Iran for anybody else who wanted to go?
Of course.
It was fun too?
It was fun. Everybody thought that we were political, so we were constantly being watched by very, very friendly guides. A tour guide set up like, okay, we'll let them in, but you have to spy on them. Okay, we'll do it. It's one of the safest countries in the world for Americans to visit. It's like Britain or Canada. U.S. allies are responsible for some of the most feared violence. When we went to the cemetery, we had to go to the Haftatir mausoleum, victims of an MEK bombing. A lot of – if you hear our senators, and especially on the Republicans, praising the new future government of Iran, the MEK, a sort of Marxist – no longer so Marxist – Islamist sort of cult, yeah, that has killed a number of prime ministers and presidents, and fought on the side of Saddam during the Iraq War, and has carried out assassinations for Israel more recently, and are the most hated people you could possibly hope to put in a new democratic government. They're the most hated people in that country, and yet we say that we're going to bring democracy by installing them as the new leaders. That's not a goal.
And John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani speak to their organization
We've
all
been
the time.
Campaigning to Nancy Pelosi to back off.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had a fascinating time. Sean Reynolds and Sarah Ball are both members of the peace organization Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Their trip to Iran was with the peace organization Code Pink. Thanks a lot for joining us, talking about your trip. You've put some stuff up online on it on the Voices website. And
yes,
people can read a transcript of your interview or your conversation with Javad Zarif, the foreign minister. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, we're going to find out about the golden age of Islamic science. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. We're going to find out a few things now about the golden age of Islamic science. With us is Ahmed Sadri, professor of sociology at Lake Forest College. His latest book is an illustrated adaptation of the Persian classic Shahnameh, the epic of the Persian kings. And it's good to see you again, Ahmed, who we talk with regularly. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Aaron Freeman, a longtime friend of WBEZ, an artist in residence of the Chicago Council for Science and Technology. And he and Professor Sadri chat regularly on Aaron's YouTube channel, Sciency Optimist, and have been talking about the golden age of Islamic science. Aaron, what got you interested in the golden age of Islamic science?
Well, you know, because Ahmad knows about it.
And you're a curious guy.
I'm a sciency optimist. But no, Ahmad and I regularly talk about various things sociological on Sciency Optimist YouTube channel. And we were just chatting always every week, as you know. Well, what's the topic? What's going to be the topic? And he was just telling me a little about the history. I knew a little about that Islam was owned science, as a matter of fact. For example, that most of the stars that have names have Islamic names. And I have heard of algebra and algorithms, and I understand that those are Islamic words and the name for Islamic people.
Cool. And when was the age of Islamic science, Ahmed?
Well, it pretty much coincided with the European Dark Ages. So usually when Western historians of science or experts on, you know, West Asian literature think of Iran in that time, sometimes they tend to generalize, thinking that since there was Dark Ages or late antiquity in Europe, the same applied to Iran. For instance, there has been this speculation that the Shahnameh, the epic of the Persian kings, that was finished 1,009 years ago, come March 8th, they assume that this was written down as the author, Ferdowsi, the poet, went to oral recitations. Assumption is that these things were not written, and right. This poet was some kind of a Homer writing down from oral productions. Indeed, this wasn't true. Ferdowsi worked from a written archetype, and it's because that was a literate society full of people who were perfectly capable of reading and really good critics of poetry. And so we know this because at the end of the book, Ferdowsi, who is a very, very proud poet, he confesses that this 60,000 couplet lines that he has written, the longest poem ever written by a single human being in the history of mankind, there are 500 so-so lines in it. And people have speculated, why would he say something like that? And the best answer I have heard is that he knew that there are people who can read these and criticize them, yep. And he was kind of covering himself. And so this is a literate society. He's working out of a archetype, and science was one of the things that was in the air.
Well, can I say, I mean, how literate were they? Well, first of all, I want to say that in due respect to our Persian brothers and sisters, the center of science in the Islamic world in the 8th to 12th centuries was Baghdad. That was everybody who was anybody, Christians, Jews, they wanted everybody there. But they were so good that at a time the Muslims were translating the Greeks in the Greek philosophy, Greek mathematics into Arabic at a time when Charlemagne, the king of the Holy Roman Empire, was just starting to learn to write his own name. These guys were amazing.
Tell us about the House of Wisdom. What is that about?
So during the Abbasid period, the second Islamic dynasty, that took over about a century after the dawn of Islam, there was a great interest in translating Greek literature and science, astronomy, into Arabic. Also, they ended up translating a lot of Indian science and mathematics. And part of this Renaissance that occurred in Central Asia and Iran and the Islamic world, including Baghdad, is a result of this confluence of ideas. Muslims took the idea of zero from Indian mathematicians, and this gave rise to algebra. Greeks were great in geometry, not so good in math because of their system of notation. So this kind of positional notation, zero, that and decimal system that Iranians and Muslims took from India, and Greek astronomy and Greek medicine, all of this kind of worked together in the Abbasid period, the period of translation, the period of combining these ideas very creatively, the period that the previous systems in the region, the caste systems, have been knocked down by the Islamic invasion. And in this new era, new ideas really created this critical mass that led to this scientific discoveries in astronomy, in medicine, in philosophy, in literature.
And one of the things that's really useful to note is that Baghdad was a very open community. Like, they welcomed scholars. All they cared about was your scholarship. Your religion, where you came from, was irrelevant. They wanted to learn and learn, and they wanted to get all – they wanted to translate everybody's scientific work, everybody's literature, everybody's mathematics, from whatever language they were, into Arabic.
So this seems to be a something that all great learning societies do. You poach the other guy's science. You've got to do it. I mean, the United States. I mean, we've done it a lot.
Indeed. Indeed. Civilizations are great in plagiarizing each other.
Right. So, and the great civilizations do plagiarize.
You bring it on and make your own thing.
Yeah. So they are not really good at recognizing the sources, but they plagiarize. Every great civilization has been in the business of plagiarizing their neighboring civilizations. And it is in those areas that we really find exciting new leaps, exciting new ideas that emerge. And the Islamic civilization and the Iranian civilization was no exception. They took from Chinese, they took from Indians, they took from ancient Babylonians and the Greeks. And in the middle, in this ferment, in this great culture, new ideas were born.
Yep.
Tell us about the man who's credited with inventing algebra and algorithm and all the rest.
So, algorithm was created, invented by this man named Al-Khwarizmi, whose name is corrupted in algorithm. And from very early translations, Latin translations, we know that they had great respect for algorithm for Al-Khwarizmi. And whenever they referred to him, they basically would say, "Thus spoke Al-Khwarizmi." They were really, really impressed by algorithm, and for good reason. You know, this is what our computers are based on. So this great development of, if enlightenment is anything, is recognizing the power of human reason. Yeah. The power of human reason that sometimes works against revelation, sometimes works in tandem with revelation, sometimes claims that revelation is reasonable. There was great creative contacts with revelation. Mathematician of this era, Al-Biruni, had a wonderful conversation in four letters with another great physician and mathematician and astronomer, Avicenna. And the basic debate was whether we should accept Aristotelian view of the universe or whether we should go with our observations. Al-Biruni was saying our observations is that these heavenly bodies are moving in ellipses, not in circles. And the Aristotelian, Avicenna, was saying, no, circle, according to the great teacher, Aristotle is the best, most beautiful, most perfect shape, and they must go according to these circular systems. So Al-Biruni says, I don't care what Aristotle said. I will go with my observations. And by the way, based on these observations, they very accurately calculated the circumference of the Earth. And one of the students of Al-Biruni, Al-Furqani, wrote a book very accurately calculating the circumference of the Earth. And this is the book that Christoph Klump worked from. And the only problem that existed was he miscalculated because he didn't convert Arabic miles into European miles. And that is why he thought he had arrived in India when he had arrived in America. So, and actually Al-Biruni, not only he calculated the circumference of the globe, he also speculated that there should be a mass of land on the other side, because it would make no sense that all the mass of Earth would be on one side and the other side being empty. So even speculated about the existence of the landmass of America.
Totally fascinating. Now, I want to ask about how the age of Islamic science came to an end. What happened? Why did this ever stop?
Can I say one about that? Because that I love Neil deGrasse Tyson. I adore Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's a great man, a great scientist. But he said something that I repeated for years, which wasn't right, which was that Al-Ghazali, one of the imams of Baghdad, had banned mathematics as a tool of the devil. Which, and I've repeated this story many times, and it's not true. So even if it's Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I'm glad you've been able to right the ship here.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying it is true. But they, what was your question?
Why did it come to an end? Why did the age of science come to end? Because this guy said said this fake thing? Or
No. Tell us, Ahmad, what happened?
I think, First of all, we should say they had a great run.
Yes.
Right, then nothing lasts forever.
From the 8th century
and they
to the 12th.
Had a really great run for 300 years.
And that we still benefit from now. And algorithms are why a lot of people will be hearing the show.
Indeed. And so the idea is that, yes, it ended. And my speculation is that they had a counter-enlightenment, very much like the European counter-enlightenment. Remember that from the European counter-enlightenment, we had communism, ultimately, as one of these progenies, and fascism. And we really had to fight very hard, and we are still fighting against those extremist views about how the society should be run, how liberal democracy is not really right, and we should go to one extreme or the other extreme. This counter-enlightenment had proponents, and Al-Ghazali was one of them. And enlightenment doesn't end because of one person.
Right.
But Al-Ghazali's views, he was a very clever philosopher. He was a great scientist. But his ideas tended towards mysticism at the expense of independent reason.
But also, Al-Ghazali wasn't an ignorant anti-scientist. He was a very smart. I mean, he read Plato and he read the people he opposed to. And in matter of fact, he wrote an analysis of Plato that
right.
was taught in European school. A contradiction, a challenge, a critique of Plato that for many years later the Europeans used. You can't understand Plato unless you read Al-Ghazali's criticism of Plato.
Right. So the idea is that he wanted to reject Plato.
Right.
He didn't like Plato, but he said, first, you know who Plato is. And he wrote the definitive book that for a long time people mistook for the work of Plato because he didn't want to attack a straw man. He developed Platonic philosophy perfectly so well that it became the classic textbook on Plato, and he goes on to reject it in another book. So this is not really an ignoramus that says, mathematics is the work of devil.
Aaron?
Oh, I was going to say, my takeaway from all this is that, one, scientific progress is not inevitable because, again, while the Muslims were having their great scientific revolution, the Europeans were in the Dark Ages trying to figure out how to write their names, and also that scientific advances are not necessarily permanent. The Muslims had theirs, and then it went away. And it's useful to note that.
Protect your age of enlightenment.
Protect your age of enlightenment.
Jealously.
Jealously, absolutely. Yes.
Ahmed Sadri's professor of sociology at Lake Forest College. His latest book is an illustrated adaptation of the Persian classic Shahnameh, the epic of the Persian kings. Aaron Freeman's a longtime friend of WBEZ. He is artist in residence of the Chicago Council for Science and Technology. He and Ahmed Sadri chat regularly on Aaron's YouTube channel, Sciency Optimist. Check it out. Good to see you guys.
Thank you, dear brother.
Pleasure.
We love Mike Gilmore.
Coming up after the break, we'll have Global Notes, our look at international music, and we'll get into some Sima Funk. I'm Jerome McDonald. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. It's time for Global Notes, our look at international music, with Catalina Maria Johnson, the host and producer of Beat Latino on Vocalo. Great to see you, Catalina.
Hey, Jerome. Great to see you again.
So you brought a friend this time.
Well, this is an amazing artist who I caught just a couple weeks ago at South by Twice.
You told us about him here on Worldview.
I told you about him. And Eric Iglesias Rodriguez, a.k.a. Sima Funk. And then I went last night to Martyrs to see him. And I might go again tonight to Old Town. I mean, he's an amazing, amazing artist. And it's a pleasure to have him here. Hi, Eric Sima Funk. How
Hola.
Are you doing? ¿Qué tal?
Great.
thanks so much for being here with us. And it's a treat to have seen you several times and to have one more chance. Tell us a little bit. Let's start by the name, Sima Funk. I think that's very important for people to
know.
Yeah.
The name is Sima came from Cimarron. Cimarron were the slave in Cuba who escaped, in many places, the African slave that escaped from the house of the master and started to live in the middle of the forest, you know, like hiding and stuff. They built communities there. So they was calling Cimarrones. So Cimarron came from that, and because they have a lot of influence in the Afro-Cuban culture, Afro-Cuban music and visuality. And the funk, well, is the funk. So I mix that because I'm a big fan of funk music and the Afro-Cuban music. So I try to put me a name. I put myself a name. Consequence with that.
You know, I was looking at some of the material on you, and it was saying that you were influenced by a cassette of Lionel Richie. Where were you getting your music when you were in Cuba, when you were growing up? What was influencing you?
Yeah, that was part of that. That's something that I remember a couple of months ago, because I was with all the interviews and stuff that people asked me, and it's good because I remember more at that time. But yeah, I get some Lionel Richie, get Michael Jackson, also Invisible, that is my favorite album. Again, Madonna. Was my uncle who brought all this music to the house. But yeah, many, many influence. Funkadelic, also Edward on Fire, Ohio Players.
Wow.
All the good stuff.
I've also heard all that. I've also heard that you chose these musics and funk and reggae in particular because of their history, you know, because of their history with African descendants. Is that true?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's that I live in Cuba. I'm born in Cuba. So it's like you have the influence of Africa like 100% in every square. And when you make like music, danceable music, that I love danceable music, and I do a lot of danceable music, you have to sing in Africa because they bring us the groove. They bring us the drum to Cuba.
We're talking with Sima Funk. He's at the Old Town School of Folk Music tonight for the price of whatever you want to give. It's a free maybe $10 thing
donation,
there at the Old Town School of Folk Music. I want to play a cut. We're going to hear what's your big single here.
My big single.
Me voy?
No, she know. Yeah. It's that one.
Let's hear it.
Oye. Prepárate. Me voy pa' mi casa. Me voy
me voy pa' la tuya. Si tú quieres, yo me voy contigo. Mamá, si tú quieres, yo voy pa' la tuya. Dile. Ya se acabó la fiesta. En la calle no hay nada. Pero tú estás pa' cosas y yo no estoy pa' drama. Vamos a ponernos de acuerdo. Los dos queremos lo mismo. Yo puedo seguir pa' mi casa o puedo cogerte el ritmo. Dime que tú quieras hacer pa' yo saber que voy a hacer pa' bla, bla, bla. No tengo tiempo. Ya me está cayendo la impaciencia. No da sombrecita, suelta el coro del momento. Me voy.
That's Sima Funk. He's an Afro-Cuban musician, and this is off his debut album, Terapia, and he's embarking on his first tour of the U.S. and playing at the Old Town School of Folk Music tonight. Tell me something about Cuban touring America. It's got to be, is it easy to get a visa? You've got a big tour planned. You're hauling a lot of people around with this band. What's it like?
Yeah, no, the visa is, you have to ask from the embassy. We don't have the embassy, so we travel to other place to ask for the visa. But it wasn't a difficult tramit. We get it easy, and now here it's like for many places, a lot of people supporting, a lot of people communicating with us. Like great, great, great. They are super glad that we arrived to US and we make it too. With this kind of music, they have this. It's a great time. We're having the greatest days.
Tell me about your band. They're pretty large.
Yeah, we have 10 people in the band, and we will increase now in a couple months. Yeah, we are friends. Most that all. We live together. And we pass all this together, and they have a beautiful energy.
Were you thinking about leaving a few of them home? It seems like I do this with five, isn't there?
No. No, we need everybody, man. It's a tribe.
You got a lot of sound.
Yeah, we need that, we need that, we need that, we need that.
Yeah, it's a big sound. And so Eric, as a singer and composer and producer, I was also, and this album is called Terapia, which is therapy. Mm-hmm. And I read that two things. One is you studied medical school very briefly, so your family has a number of like a surgeon and a therapist.
You
also were in the church choir, and certainly your music is a healing experience. So did you bring a medical school and the church, going to church into your music as a
yeah, of course, definitely. When you hear the album Therapy, it's about that. It's about heal. It's about medicine, happiness, all mixed with sexuality, also with the pretty and awesome, grateful to be here, to have time in life. So it's about that. It's about taking the time for and live your life, enjoy it. Give thanks for being here.
Well, thanks and praise. And I'd love to play Alabao, which is right. I mean, it's often the title of church songs because it's Alabao, which means praise or praise the Lord, right?
Yeah. So, but we say that in Pinar del Río, my hometown. When you say something, when you see something like a non-normal thing, you say Alabao, like oh my God.
Oh, okay. Well, this is praise and oh my God, and Pinar del Río's special twist on that word.
Al final siempre te enreda y se calienta, alabao. Otra vez nos fuimos. Un movimiento bien lento. Sacude cadera, chula pelea con esto, alabao. Otra vez nos fuimos. Un movimiento bien lento. De cadera chula pelea con esto, ven, ven. Yo te prefiero en esa ruta antipática, molesta y astuta. Quiero terminar lastimado, que me deje fatigado. Y estoy para contarle a tu mamá, pa' que ella vea que yo no soy el malo, nada. Pa' que se entere tu papá. Que la niña no es tan buena, que la niña es la candela. Alabao, otra vez nos fuimos.
Hey, Sima Funk, and he's performing tonight at the Old Town School of Folk Music. That's a terrific song. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm excited for it right there.
So, Jerome mentioned your large band, which is amazing, so textured, and you have a The one woman is both a trombonist, which is a, you know, hefty instrument, and a vocalist. Tell us a little bit about your band members. Are they from Havana, from Pinar del Rio?
They're only from Pinar del Rio is me. The guitar is from Matanza. I have two girls in the trombone, but I have one of them, Diana. She's in Germany right now because she has another compromise before being with me, so she's finished that. She's finishing that for a ride to U.S.
Do you think you're the first band in the world that has used backup singers as trombone players?
I don't know.
That's pretty awesome. That's a good idea. And it's a difficult instrument.
Yeah, it's really difficult, but she has the sound, like really serious sound. This girl is have the potent sound. I love that. I just was trying to see what kind of horn instrument I could put, but I didn't know. I don't know about music, so they appear. They say to me, "Oh, why do you not put this?" I say, "Okay, let's put two trombones," and it sounds like a super strong. It sounds super strong.
And you're very, very, very tight. I mean, how long have you been playing together with these 8 to 10?
We have been playing together maybe for, well, with the trombones, is the band have been playing together for 1 year. But not all of us. The trombone came in 5 months ago, and a couple of musicians came 3 months ago. We passed a lot of time showing the musicians. But finally, we have the musician that we need. Now we will put two more. I don't find any yet, but I will increase the number of the band.
So I have to ask about your dance moves. You've been compared to James Brown and Fela Kuti.
Yeah.
And there's a little Michael Jackson, but you're amazing. So is the dance as well as the music kind of self-taught?
Kind of what?
Self-taught? You taught yourself? I mean, how did you pick up? The moves are amazing.
I don't know. That for real started one day. Normally, I didn't know that I could move in the stage or some stuff like that. But at one moment, I say, okay, maybe I can move in the stage. So I tell you the reference that I have. I'm a big fan of James, of course, and Fela, Groove, and Prince also is amazing dancer.
That makes sense.
And the Cuban dancer also, Benny Morey, was a great dancer. And so I move. I don't know how, but I do.
It sounds like people in the audience end up moving too. You saw it twice at South by Southwest, Catalina. What happens in the audience? I mean, those are hardcore music people.
I mean,
it was amazing.
It's irresistible. I mean, you just can't. For one, the lyrics are smart, so if you know Spanish, you're kind of processing that the lyrics are very, sometimes even humorous. And I have to reflect, as always, on life in Cuba. But at the same time, there's this, you just start moving. You just can't stop. And it's absolutely, absolutely irresistible.
No, thank you. That's great.
But speaking of Lionel Richie and so there's also a couple of ballads in the album, just sort of very smooth, right?
And
I read that you also picked up a lot, and that has to do with the words, with trova, with the troubadour, the kind of singer-songwriter movement. And that was the way you started.
Yeah, definitely. I made trova in Pinar del Rio and was there. I learned to write, because they write a lot of complicated words in many sense, and it's a crazy movement of words. So I try to do also. I don't believe that I'm so good writing in the trova movement, but I bring to the danceable music, and it's amazing the combination, because always I'm trying always that the people can understand the message.
Well, Sima Funk,
I learned that in the trova.
Sima Funk, it's been great to have you, and congratulations
on your
career. The new album is Terapia, and you can see Sima Funk tonight at the Old Town School of Folk Music. It is a free offering and a great opportunity to see Sima Funk live and in person, and get a little dancing done on a Wednesday night.
And even kind of, and even kind of some slow dancing. I chose a little bit of a ballad so that we could. So we're going to go back to Me Voy. Me Voy, entonces, so the dancing, the serious dancing. So get ready, get your dancing shoes on, although you took your shoes off last night. So, you know, get your dancing shoes on and be ready to take them off in the middle.
That's right. That's the only scene that we need.
Sima Funk, thanks a lot for joining us. And culture writer Catalina Maria Johnson, the host of Beat Latino, heard on Vocalo at 11 a.m. on Sundays. Thanks a lot for joining us for another edition of Global Notes.
Thanks to you.
Tomorrow on Worldview, we'll talk about a peace summit that's happening this weekend. Hope you can join us. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. Thanks to Char Dastin, Jenny Friedland, and Ashish Valentine for production assistance, and Mike Gilmore for engineering. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.